scenario that usually pops up when you're talking about marriage and divorce and remarriage, and the Romans 7 passage comes up. Two scenarios that usually are thought about. There's a husband and a wife, and the husband dies, and then the wife is she remarries. Or you could swap the people around. Same principle. We have that scenario. Or we have the husband and the wife scenario, and then there is a divorce and a remarriage, and then the previous spouse dies. And the question is, what about that remarriage? That's what was asked last Sunday. Now, typically, of these two scenarios, which one is usually asked about and talked about when we come to Romans 7 in discussions on marriage, divorce, and remarriage? The top one or the bottom one? Yeah, the bottom one. That's what normally we talk about. That's the most common MDR scenario that's presented when you think about Romans 7. However, of the two, which one more closely follows the text? It's the top one. Okay? It's the top one. Now, watch those boxes across the top as we change them. Remember, Paul wrote this not because he wanted to talk about marriage and divorce and remarriage. That wasn't his subject matter. He's talking to Jewish Christians. Jewish Christians who need to be convinced that they need to leave the law, or that they've left the law, and be married to Christ. You see in verse 4 of Romans 7, we didn't particularly look at verse 4 yet, although it's the climax or the summation of these passages dealing with the marriage and divorce question. He says, "Therefore, my brethren, you were also made to die to the law through the body of Christ, that you might be joined to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that we might bear fruit for God." So here is the Jew and the law. They're married, so to speak. But what's happened to the law? It's dead. Colossians 2, one passage says that Jesus nailed the law to the cross. It's done. It's died. So the law dies. And what then is the Jew free to do? As Paul argues here in this text, he's free to be married to Christ. And what not occur in the mind of the Jew? Spiritual adultery. That's right. Now, that really correctly parallels the passage. Okay? And so, what I want to emphasize is that Romans 7, verses 2 through 4, may indeed contain principles that can be applied to this scenario that we usually want to talk about and think about. There may be principles there. However, that scenario doesn't most correctly match the text, does it? No, it's the first one. So what I want to say is that we need to be careful that we don't somehow force a scenario onto a text when it doesn't closely follow all the steps that the text presents. Would you agree with that? I think that's so. So the question was asked, you know, what about that marriage that took place when the divorce took place from the previous marriage, and then after the remarriage took place, then the original spouse died? What about that? Well, that's going to have to be thought about and prayed about and studied about. But the conclusion that I came to this week is that the text really doesn't mirror that scenario. This is the scenario that really mirrors. I don't think, if we could bring Paul up here and ask him, "Paul, did you have in mind a situation where there's a marriage and then there's an unlawful divorce and then there's a remarriage and the first spouse dies? Is that what you really were thinking about?" What do you think he'd say? I think he'd say no. I think he'd say this is what the Holy Spirit was talking about, is that there was a marriage and then there's a death and then there's a remarriage, and that's not adulterous because the law has released the one from that marriage bond because the death severs it. I think that's really what he would say. So I just wanted to go over that. Okay, we were talking about this last Sunday, that the real possibility exists when you come to Romans 7, and one must come to this conclusion, is that there is a difference between the marriage and the bond. We must understand that. And it seems somewhat redundant to say that, but we must, because there are many, many influential brethren who are teaching there's no such thing as the distinction between the marriage and the bond. And I don't know how you get around Romans 7. I don't see it myself. But that's the real possibility that exists. The marriage that's discussed in the first part of verse 3 is adulterous, as Paul mentions. And again, why is it adulterous? Because who's still living? The first spouse is still living. That's why it's adultery. And the implied divorce that took place, although the text does not, you can't even find the word divorce in there, but you have to imply that that's what happened. That implied divorce was unlawful. And we have to take that position also, because what did Jesus already taught about divorce and remarriage? If it's a lawful divorce, then there's no adultery. So for Paul to be saying something is adulterous here, it's going to have to be an unlawful divorce. So we talked about that. And then when we illustrated this scenario that's taught for us in Romans 7, we looked at Mark 6 and these questions starting at the bottom of page 16, looking at Herod and Herodias. So let's diagram Herod and Herodias, which we did last, we talked about it last week. Here's Philip and there is Herodias. And as we noticed, they were married. But the thing is, there is another situation to consider, and that's Romans 7 teaches that they not only were married, but they're bound. So there is again a difference between the marriage and the bond. Well, there's Philip's brother Herod out here. And as you recall last Sunday, I read from some secular information, both from Josephus and the International Standard Biblical Encyclopedia, who talked about some things that took place. That's been recorded for us in secular history. And they had that agreement. Remember, they met at Rome and they agreed to divorce their wives and come together. A very modern situation that took place back then also. So Herodias took it upon herself, I'm going to divorce my husband. And so she puts Philip away. Are they married? No, they're not married. They're not married. And let's stay away from they're married in the eyes of God. Let's not use that talk, that language, because the Bible doesn't use that language. They're just not married. But are they still bound? Yes. They're still bound, but they're not married. So what happens now is, because they had that agreement, then Herodias hooks up with Herod, so to speak, and they get married. But we must not forget, she is still bound to Philip, even though she put him away. And these passages here, Genesis 2, which we've looked at, Matthew 19, which we've looked at. So, what is Herodias' situation? You can't see the blue box, but you can see the black one. But there's the blue one behind that one. So, what's Herodias' situation? She is married to one, but she's bound to another. She's married to her second husband, but she's still bound to her original spouse. And John said to Herod, what? It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Now, as we mentioned, technically she's not Philip's wife, is she? She's divorced. We understood that to be some accommodative use of the Scripture. We went back even to the Old Testament. Even though Uriah is dead in 2 Samuel, Bathsheba is still referred to as what? The wife of Uriah. Well, she can't be married to him. He's dead. Because the Scripture doesn't have terms like former wife, former husband, ex-wife, ex-husband that we use in our language. It just uses the terms husband and wife. So John says, it's not lawful because what's happened is you are married to one and yet you're still bound to another. That's the situation in Romans 7. And Mark 6 clearly illustrates that same principle. Okay? So I wanted to throw this diagram up here to illustrate that's what we were talking about. And that's really the focus of Romans 7 and Mark 6. Okay. Yes. Yes, they're bound by the marriage law. The best way I've always thought about it is this. Marriage is what we do. Marriage is the civil ceremony. And as we've already said previously, has that not differed from culture to culture, generation to generation? Whatever required one to be married civilly 300 years ago is not required today. Does that mean that people weren't any less married 300 years ago than we are today? No, it's just different situations, different civilizations, different cultures, whatever. But marriage is what we do. But where is the bond? That's in the mind of God. That's in God's mind. God does the joining. God does the binding. And since only God does the binding, then who can only do the loosing? Only God can do the loosing. So that, if we look at Matthew 19, and Jesus said, "Whosoever divorces his wife, except it be for fornication, and marry another." Well, how come that's not adultery? There's a divorce and there's a remarriage. Why is it adulterous? Because what's happened in God's mind? He put that person out of the bond. He gave them an out. The divorce took place, but marriage and divorce, this what we do civilly here, doesn't solve matters. God had to be involved in that and say, "I'm either going to keep you in the bond or I'm going to release you from the bond." And only God can do that. So, the bond is in the mind of God. We don't control that. So that's what we mean bound. It's by the marriage law. Okay, one more question we want to ask, and that's the question E on page 17 about John's teaching. What truth are we reminded of when we have to teach the truth on something? Sam, we're still looking at Mark 6. What happened to John? He lost his life. Now, I don't think it's going to be very likely that for us to lose our lives today if we get up and preach the truth. It may come to that someday. We're getting worse as a culture all the time. But John just simply preached the truth, taught the truth, and looked Herod right in the eye and said, "It is not lawful for you to have this woman." And it didn't seem to upset him so much as it really upset who? Herodias. And so she used the situation to her advantage, manipulated it somewhat. And the question that was asked of the daughter, "I'll give you whatever you want up to half my kingdom." Now, when he said that, what do you think most people would have said they'd wanted? What would you have taken? A half the kingdom. That's what I would have taken. But what did the daughter, upon instructions from Herodias, what did she say? "Give me the head of John the Baptist on the platter. We'll just end this situation right now." And so he was beheaded. And so because of what he had taught. So this tragic episode regarding John reminds us that sometimes for standing for truth, and not just teaching truth, but just standing for truth, but especially teaching truth, that's going to be a cost. Jesus talked about, remember, being ready to count the cost, Luke chapter 14. He just says there to be my disciple. That wouldn't necessarily involve any teaching, but the principle is still the same. And in 2 Timothy 4, Paul reminds us that the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but they'll have what kind of ears? They'll have itching ears. They want somebody to scratch them. They want to be told, "Don't tell us what we need to hear, tell us what we want to hear." Well, they didn't want to hear that, but John told them anyway. And so preachers, teachers, disciples, elders, the principle's the same. We need to be ready to stand for truth. And what if it comes at a high cost? That's the way it is. We got to pay. Because we cannot water down or compromise truth. Okay. Any other questions or comments about the situation in Mark 6 that illustrates Romans 7 before we move on? Anybody? You have the floor if you want to say something. Okay. Now turn to 1 Corinthians 7. This is the last passage we'll look at when it comes to divorce and remarriage. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This chapter of the first letter to the Christians at Corinth begins a distinct section in the epistle. How does the beginning of verse 1 read in chapter 7? No, that's 2 Corinthians. That's a good book, but we want the first one. Yeah, that's right. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 1. Okay, now concerning the things about which you wrote. So there had been a previous letter written from the church to Paul. And they had asked him, obviously they had asked him some questions. And so Paul says, he's covered what he's already talked about through chapter 6. And he says, "Now let me address these things that you wrote about." What's the first thing he deals with? Marriage, fornication, the relationships between husbands and wives. In fact, the entire 7th chapter deals with marriage and divorce, fornication that may result, adultery, all those things. So that's the first topic that Paul deals with. And when we include this chapter in the marriage, divorce, and remarriage discussion, I think it's good to remember what may very well be the thematic verse of the chapter. Look at verse 26. We won't talk about that, but I think that may be the theme. What's Paul talk about, Buford, in verse 26 of chapter 7? Some kind of distress. Paul says some present distress that was affecting the Christians. We don't know what it was. But possibly, if we look at that correctly, maybe it was making it hard to be married. Maybe it was making it tough on couples. Whatever it was. I think it's good to look at that. In fact, Paul says, I think, this is Paul's opinion, now in view of the present distress, I think it's good for a man to remain what? As he is. And Paul really was saying by that, what if I'm talking about a single man? What was Paul's opinion? I think what? I think you ought to stay that way. Now, what if you're already married? Well, then Paul's opinion doesn't really matter because what have you done? You've already married and you're bound in the mind of God to that husband or wife, so you can't say, well, and things are tough, I think I'll step out of this marriage. No, we can't do that. But Paul was mainly talking about single people. I think it's better if you just stay like you are. It'll be better on you in view of this present distress. Now, let's go ahead and say this before we get to the text itself. Whether there's a cultural distress or not present, if there is no distress, if there is a distress, what does that have to do with the laws about marriage? Does it change it? Not a bit. It doesn't change it at all. I don't know of a present distress in our culture. Maybe we can sit around and invent one. I don't think we can name one, though, that really makes it tough for Christians today to be married. But even if we had one, that doesn't change or alter the Lord's teaching on marriage and divorce. The original marriage law, again, Jesus used it two times in Matthew 19. He referred back or at the beginning. That's what doesn't change. Okay, yes, sir. Yes, 1 Timothy 5. Yes, in 1 Timothy 5, a younger widow, he says it's good that they remarry and that they bear children and that they guide their house. So this was just something for Corinth, apparently. Something specific that was affecting those Christians. But 1 Timothy 5 is a good one to think about. That's good, Wayne. Okay, this is question 35. And all we're going to look at is verses 10 and 11. In the divorce lesson. We're going to look at verses 12 through 15, as you'll see in what I gave you today in lesson 4, in the remarriage lesson. Okay. Before I get to question 35, I wrote myself a note here, and I want to make sure I cover this. I didn't ask a question about this, but I do want you to look now at the first five verses of chapter 7. I think it's good if we discuss this real quickly. There are some people who will teach and believe and teach that it's okay to separate as long as you don't get a divorce. They would say, well, we know divorce is not right, and so we're just gonna separate. Tammy and I used to worship at a church several years ago, and she wasn't elderly, but she was she wasn't young either, so middle age, I guess we'll say. She came and wanted to identify with the church. We didn't have elders, so the men had to meet and discuss those kinds of things. And she wanted to place membership, so she talked to the preacher, and he was all for her coming. He knew her from years ago. He was very good friends with both her and her husband, but her husband wasn't going to come. It was just going to be her. Well, naturally, some of us asked the question, well, what about her marriage? We weren't trying to be nosy or pry, but it's a fellowship question. I mean, it dealt with fellowship, and, you know, are they divorced? And if so, then, you know, was it a lawful divorce or whatever? No, they're not divorced. They're just separated. And they've been separated for about 15 years. And that was their situation. Well, someone said, well, where do you get that in the Scripture? Guess where the preacher went? 1 Corinthians 7, the first five verses. All right. Let's read those verses. Trenton, if you'll read the first five verses, please, of 1 Corinthians 7, then we'll talk about it real quick.
Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves fasting and prayer, and come together again, so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control.
Okay, thank you. Now, usually they're going to refer to verse 5. But verse 5 is in a context. So Paul is talking in the previous verses, starting at verses 2 through 4 especially. What's he teaching? What's he reminding husbands and wives about? That's right. In fact, the old King James uses what phrase? You render the due benevolence to your husband or your wife. It's due. It's owed them. It's talking about affection. It's talking about even the sexual privileges that can be enjoyed in marriage. Remember in Hebrews 13, verse 4, marriage is honorable and the bed is undefiled. So only in marriage is the bed, sexual intercourse, not defiled behavior. And you owe that to your spouse. And then Paul even says, look, addressing husbands, you don't even have authority over your own body. It's not yours. In the very strong sense, whose is it? It's your wife's. And likewise, she doesn't control her body, it belongs to you. So then he says in verse 5, do not or stop depriving one another. It's wrong to use the marriage bed as a weapon, isn't it? To beat your spouse over the head with it and to withhold yourself. Is that a problem in a lot of marriages? Yes, it is. And it's sinful. It's wrong. Okay. So having said all that, so he says don't defraud. But then there's some exception here he talks about. Albert, what's he say in verse 5? About when he says don't defraud, then what kind of things does he say? Okay. Fasting and prayer. And one more thing he says has to take place. There has to be an agreement or consent that what? That you're going to come back. Now, I don't think 18 years qualifies, do you? Now, I'm not trying to pick on anybody who's not here to defend themselves, but that was that situation. Now, when people take the position that it's okay to separate, we don't think divorce is right. Divorce is sinful. And they can quote Malachi 2:16 just like anybody else can. God hates divorce. So we're not going to divorce, but we just can't get along, so we're going to separate. Well, for how long? Well, I don't know. It could be weeks, months. It could be years. That situation, it was years. Does that kind of situation, the other ones you bring up, 1 Corinthians 7, verse 5, does it match what verse 5 is teaching? Do you think it's appropriate to use that passage that way? I don't either. That's not what Paul's talking about. This is talking about a separation that is mutually consented upon by both the husband and wife for whatever reasons that are personal to them. They are going to withhold themselves for what spiritual reasons? Fasting and prayer, not being able to get along and just separating one another, those aren't spiritual activities. They're just not trying to make the marriage work. But those who mutually consent, we're going to fast, we're going to pray, we're going to study, whatever they've decided to do, they're going to do this, but they also agree to do what? We're going to come back. This is not a solution. In fact, I would even say this is a short-term situation. It's not long term. Because what happens if you continually, as Paul concludes verse 5, if you don't ever come back and you just keep withholding and you keep withholding, even if it's for the reasons that Paul mentions in verse 5, what happens? What a temptation to do what? Absolutely. Somebody will eventually yield. They'll have a lack of self-control. And they'll go out and they'll commit fornication. And then that's when it really gets messed up. Yes, sir.
There are hardly any times you find anybody fasting and praying over 2 or 3 days.
That's right. That's true.
That's,
That's true. It's short term, very, very short term. It's to stay away. You're right. You're right. Yes. So I just wanted to bring up these verses, even though we're not really going to talk about them. But some will use these passages to justify, and it's their proof text. Well, you know, the Bible will talk about separation. Well, not the way that you're trying to make it talk about. Yes, one. Yes. Yes. You're robbing your spouse of something that belongs to them. And, frankly, something that you promised when you exchanged your wedding vows. You promised that you would be faithful and true. And that implies that you will render to your spouse all the things that belong to him or to her. So I just wanted to bring up real quickly this passage and see how it's often misused by those who advocate some kind of long-term separation. That's not what Paul was talking about. Okay, now, look at verses 10 and 11. Paul says, "But to the married I give instructions, not I, but the Lord, that the husband should not leave her husband." Excuse me, that the wife should not leave her husband. "But if she does leave, let her remain unmarried or else be reconciled to her husband, and that the husband should not send his wife away." That's from the New American Standard. Okay, let's read. Someone read from the New King James. Who has the New King James? Bobby, you have that? You read verse 10 and 11 for us from the New King James.
"Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. But even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. The husband is not to divorce his wife."
Okay. That uses the words depart and divorce. This one uses the words leave and then send his wife away. Okay. Now, who does Paul address? This is question 35 now. Who does Paul address? First part of verse 10. What's he say? To the married. Okay, to the married. Now, why would he say that? Well, look back at verse 8. Who did Paul talk about in verse 8 or talk to in verse 8? He says, to the unmarried and the widows. Okay, so he's addressing these groups. Okay, to the unmarried and the widows, verse 8. He says what he says through verse 9. Then we come to verse 10, which we're kind of jumping in at the middle of the context. Now, verse 10, he says, "Now, I got something to say to who?" Well, the married. "To the married, I have instructions for you." So he has instructions for all these groups of people who are involved in the marriage situation. Those who are not married, those who are married. So, to the married, he says, "I have instructions." And then he says this phrase, I give instructions, or I have a command, yet, not I, but the Lord. What's that say to you, Rick?
What he's saying is inspired. It wasn't something he just made up.
You know, I've got an opinion. No, that's not what Paul's saying. And I want to draw your attention to these passages. Look real quickly at chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 7, verse 17, and in chapter 14, verse 37. Three other times in the same epistle, you'll see, and I believe I gave you these passages. This is the end of question 35. What did Paul say on those occasions about things that he taught? Especially chapter 4, verse 17, chapter 7, verse 17, he says he did what? I taught the same thing where? In every church. See, Paul didn't have one message here and then one message for that. No, Paul just taught the truth wherever it was. And then at the end of the spiritual gifts section, chapter 14, Paul says that if any man think himself to be spiritual, what's he supposed to recognize? Chapter 14, verse 37. That the things which I teach are what? It's the command from God. It's the Lord's command. Okay. So, can we find some sections now back in chapter 7? Can we find some sections that were Paul's opinions? We can. Paul did say some things that were his opinion. We've already addressed one. in chapter 20, verse 26, about the present distress? Paul says, I think it's good to stay as you are in view of the present distress. That was Paul's opinion. That's not inspired. He couldn't bind that on everybody. That was just what Paul thought. But with respect to the teaching on marriage and the law that governs that, Paul says, I'm not the one talking about that. That's what the Lord is saying. That's what the Lord taught. Yes, Buford. Yes, verse 8 would be an opinion. Yes. But then he says in verse 9, but if they can't control themselves, then you just better go ahead and marry. It's better to marry than to burn with passion, uncontrollably. Go out there and commit fornication. So that would be another opinion also. But we're just emphasizing here in verse 10 when Paul says, I have something I want to say. Oh, no, not really. It's not me. It's the Lord saying that. It's command. Yes, Wayne. Yes. That's true. Yes, Paul's not giving them bad advice. It's just not the marriage law. It's just what Paul says. My personal opinion is I think you'll be better off if you stay away from marriage in view of this present distress. Be like me. There's nothing unlawful about that, but it certainly is not the Lord's teaching, because God had earlier said it's not good for man to be alone, and that has to impress us. That's what God thinks about. Okay. I'm not trying to put Paul in a bad light here. I'm just saying there are some things here that were his opinion, but this is not his opinion. Okay, now question 36. The last part of verse 10 and into verse 11. What is the teaching? He says, now to the married, I say, yet not I, but the Lord. What did he say? Okay, there should not be a divorce. Paul's teaching is do not divorce. Verse 10. Again, mine says, the wife should not leave her husband. And yours said, again, Bobby, it was depart. The wife should not depart the husband. Okay? Now, look at verse 11. And this is the wordy part of question 36. Most translations, or some translations, have verse 11, most of verse 11, in parentheses. The New American Standard has it in parentheses. Some translations set it off by hyphens or dashes. Okay? And so what I want you to see is, when he says, the last part of verse 10, the wife should not leave her husband. What does the last part of verse 11 say? And the husband is not to do what to the wife? Okay, so that's the same rule, isn't it? That's the rule. There's not supposed to be divorce. It's the part that's in between those two sections that I'm calling parenthetical, where Paul says, there's not supposed to be divorce, but, okay, if that's what's happened already, then he deals with that too. Okay? I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that's not the law. That's not the rule. The rule is no divorce. Remember we read Matthew 19 without the exception clause? And it's fair to read it that way. Now, let's read these two verses without that major section in verse 11 and see if it makes sense. Verse 10, but to the married I give instructions, not I but the Lord, that the wife should not leave her husband. Let's get to the last part of verse 11. And that the husband should not send his wife away. Is that the rule? That's the rule. That's the law. Okay? That's the law. Now, it harmonizes with what Jesus taught, which we alluded to. And the structure of this passage, I think, is comparable to what is found in 1 John chapter 2. And this is getting to the last part of question 36. So real quickly, turn to 1 John chapter 2. Let's compare these two texts. We only have time to do this morning. 1 John chapter 2. It's a passage I know that you've read before several times. Charles, when you find that, when you turn there, would you read those two verses for us, please? 1 John chapter 2, 1 and 2. Okay, let's throw these two beside each other and see if we can find some similarity. In 1 John 2, John says, what's the rule? Do not sin. That's the rule. Why was he writing these things given to him by the Holy Spirit? I write these things to you so that you do not sin. That's the rule. Okay, well, what's the exception to the rule? What if we don't do what we're supposed to do? And that happens. What if we sin anyway? All right. He says, make use of the available advocate. Now, that's not the rule. That's not the rule. The rule is don't sin. So we're going to emphasize the rule is do not sin. Okay. You see that? Now, let's look at 1 Corinthians 7. What's the rule? Do not divorce. That's the rule. Did Jesus teach that? I mean, just plainly put, that's the rule. Jesus taught it. Paul taught it. All right. What's the exception? 1 Corinthians 7. All right. If divorce takes place anyway, he says, let her remain unmarried. This is verse 11 now. But if she does depart, if she does leave, because he had taught, verse 10 now, the wife should not leave her husband. But if she leaves, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. That's the exception. But what's the rule? No divorce. That's the rule. Do you see a similarity there? I think they're very similar in their structure. Okay? So when we look at verses 10 and 11, let's pay attention to what the rule is. The rule is not verse 11. The rule is do not divorce. Well, verse 10, the second part of verse 10 and the second part of verse 11 emphasizes the same rule just from the other person's perspective, whether you're the husband or you're the wife. All right? Any questions or comments on this? I think we can all see this. That's the situation. So, given Paul's words, we need to finish this up before the bell rings. Given Paul's words when he says in verse 12, but to the rest I say, not the Lord. Now, is that opinion? The Lord's not saying this. Is this more Paul's opinion? I don't either, Rick. I would agree with you. Then what's he saying? That the Lord didn't say it, but I'm going to say it. That's right. And particularly in John 16, what did Jesus tell his apostles about verses 12 or 13? Many things I have to say to you, but what? You're not able to bear them. And this is what, and we'll just end the conversation right there. No, what did he say? But when the helper comes, he will guide you into all truth. He'll make these things known to you. So did Jesus personally discuss everything to all the apostles? No, he didn't. And I believe this is an example of that. This is kingdom law that Paul's talking about. This isn't opinion. But this is something that the Lord did not specifically address. But this came to Paul through or by inspiration. So, if you're making notes, look, jot down John 16, 12 and 13 at this place. I believe this is an example of what Jesus was talking about there. When Paul says, but to the rest I say, not the Lord. I'm saying the Lord's not. That doesn't mean it's opinion. Okay, we've got to stop for our time is gone. Appreciate your comments, your participation this morning. We're going to do our very best to finish up, and I think we can, this lesson Wednesday night, and then we'll be ready to start remarriage, the Lord willing, on next Sunday. Thank you for your comments and your participation this morning.